For this episode, we spoke with retired Houston homicide sergeant turned writer, Brian Foster. Not only has Sergeant Foster written books detailing how he and his fellow detectives kept from breaking down under the stress and bloodshed they dealt with on a daily basis, one of which is titled Homicidal Humor, he also became something of an amateur therapist for his peers, too, as they began asking Sergeant Foster to hear and write the stories of the cases that bothered them the most, to get it off their chests. Books like Blood Trails Across Texas and They Were Graveyard Dead. Please stay tuned to the end to hear Sergeant Foster talk a little bit about it. Now on to the episode.
The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
In the late 1970s, Houston was thriving. The city's oil boom was at its peak, and thousands of new residents flocked to the city, fleeing collapsing Rust Belt economies and looking for better opportunities. The city gained over 300,000 residents in the decade. Many of these new Houstonians were in their late teens, 20s, or early 30s, and hundreds of apartment complexes were developed to cater to the youthful crowd. The oil boom continued late into the decade as a result of Houston's increased production of crude oil in response to the 1979 Iranian Revolution, which halted a great deal of production in the Middle East. Demand had fallen, but nationwide panic of an impending shortage caused ridiculously long lines at the pump, often causing tempers to flare. But 1979 wasn't all battles to fill up the tank. Even with an oil crisis looming, the influx of folks moving to the Houston area in search of new opportunities during the decade created even more opportunities, naturally, and the construction and service industries were thriving. Early in 1979, too, Houston became ground zero for relations between China and the U.S. when Chinese leader Deng Xiaoping visited the city and was gifted a 10-gallon cowboy hat by a rider at a rodeo. Deng Xiaoping put on the hat, smiling as if he were a 10-year-old boy dressing up to play Texas Rangers with his friends, and the crowd ate it up, as did the millions of Americans who later saw the footage on their evening news. Regardless of Deng Xiaoping's later forfeiture of the nation's admiration due to the massacre at Tiananmen Square that would have much of the world's population viewing him and his contemporaries as little more than despotic sociopaths, in that moment, and for some time to come, his visit to the rodeo in Houston humanized the leader and helped break Americans' dismal outlook of communist China, leading to improved relations. But there was also a darker side to the city. The summer of 1979 was particularly bloody, with Houston detectives sometimes facing dozens of homicides in just one weekend. The most notorious murders that summer would put fear in the hearts of residents for years to come. The murders would become the stuff of urban legend, and they remain unsolved to this day. Within just 4 months, four young women and one young man would be killed, all within close proximity of one another, and two of the bodies would be found decapitated. The heads never recovered. Detectives were left to wonder whether there was a serial killer at work, one with a compulsion to collect human heads, or were the similarities just a coincidence? Because two of the slayings occurred in the same apartment complex, all five became synonymous with the name the Orchard Apartment Murders.
Thank you. head with a butcher knife is a heck of a job. A normal person cannot do such a thing. A normal person can't figure out why they did such a thing. Don't bother. And if you can, I would admit it to anybody.
...1979 was the deadliest year in Houston's history up until that point. By June of that year, the city surpassed the number of homicides in murder capital USA, Detroit, by almost 80, an increase of nearly 34% compared to 1978. And the bloodshed wasn't over. Houston homicide detectives were soon to be rocked with some of the most violent killings they'd ever seen. Just a few miles west and slightly south of the city center, outside the interstate that loops around downtown, are Gulfton Street and Glenmont Drive. There stood several massive apartment complexes within about a 2-square-mile area. Many of the structures attracted residents that were single, plenty of whom enjoyed the area's thriving nightlife. Some of the apartment complexes even offered nightclubs on their premises. One such complex was the Orchard Apartments, on the 5900 block of Glenmont Drive. Alice Elaine Rankin resided at the Orchard Apartments. The 33-year-old grew up in the Oak Cliff section of Dallas, where she was a National Honor Society member and sat on the student council at Adamson High School there before graduating in 1964. She was the oldest of 5 siblings born to Alice and Marvin McDonald. Alice divorced her husband of nearly 13 years in 1978 and worked as a secretary at a multidiscipline engineering consulting firm, Beauvais Engineers Incorporated. On Friday, July 27, 1979, at 7:30 a.m., Bob Smith, a coworker of Alice, arrived at her apartment to give her a lift to the office. Alice's car was at the mechanics for repair work. When he stepped to the door to knock, he saw that it was slightly ajar. "I thought she was getting her purse. I got that feeling something was wrong, a too quiet kind of feeling," Bob later told reporters at the Houston Chronicle. His gut, unfortunately, hadn't failed him. Bob knocked and called for Alice, but received no answer. So he entered his coworker's apartment. Nothing looked disturbed as he entered, and Bob made his way to Alice's bedroom, where she lay nude on the bed, her feet bound together, and a pillow covering her upper body. Nothing could have prepared Bob for the discovery he made as he pulled the pillow away. Alice's head was gone. It had been severed from her body. "I looked over my shoulder and had that feeling that if the person who did this was still around, he'd get me," Bob Smith later told the Houston Post. Strange details, such as the multiple razor blades found next to Alice's bed and body, perplexed detectives, but it was the scene itself, the violence against the victim, that would haunt their dreams, and even worse, it would haunt them when they awoke to realize that the nightmare wasn't something that they could wake up from at all. Alice Rankin's bedroom has been described by some responders as the most grisly and disturbing crime scene they'd ever seen. It was the kind of scene that responding detectives and anyone else who witnessed it would carry with them forever. For investigators who were there, confiding with their fellow officers offered the only relief, though it is imaginable that the relief did nothing to quell the hellish images that had been burnt into their minds. Though he wasn't there, now retired Houston Homicide Sergeant Brian Foster became very familiar with the crime scene.
I had a good friend that was the crime scene unit on that scene, and he told me that it was really horrendous. He said there were a lot of things that were just odd. He said, first off, the head was severed. The moving a head with a butcher knife, which is what happened there, is a heck of a job. Anyone who's ever hunted large game knows how difficult it is to remove a head from an animal, which we are animals. The suspect sat it next to the bed for a moment, obviously on the carpet, and then the suspect took the time to wipe the knife off and rinse it off and leave it in the sink, and then carried it from the apartment. Her head was being carried by the hair because he swung it back and forth. They say it was obvious because the blood was directional, and then carried it down stairs and into the parking lot where he sat it next to a car on the pavement, and he either put it on the interior of the car or the trunk and then left from there.
Though the medical examiner determined that Alice Rankin died as a result of asphyxiation caused by strangulation, she also suffered multiple stab wounds to her chest. She'd been sexually assaulted. The head of Alice Elaine Rankin has never been found. Alice's murder sent shockwaves through the entire city of Houston, and the city's detectives were already overworked and overwhelmed. Regardless, due to the unimaginably violent and graphic nature of Alice Rankin's slaying, homicide detectives hit the ground running. The crime scene detectives working Alice's case, retired Sergeant Brian Foster told us, were inventive and employed state-of-the-art techniques on the scene, and the investigators were dogged and determined. Alice, having divorced the year prior to her death, was enjoying the single life. She wasn't ready to settle down, and detectives were able to track down and question several men who she'd dated, including one man who was working on obtaining his PhD in psychology at the University of Houston, according to Sergeant Foster, as well as a man she was known to have been seeing at the time of her murder, and who was also married, an airline pilot based out of state. Sergeant Brian Foster says detectives had to visit his home to interview him, his wife and children present, after he neglected to return their phone calls regarding Alice's murder. He was given a polygraph test, and it's unclear if he was eliminated or if he remains a suspect. The violent crime wave across the city was already enough to strike fear and panic in the hearts of Houstonians far and wide, but a beheading was an entirely different nightmare. While the reality was clear, it was hard to shake the feeling that it too felt like a dream. And no matter the Houston Police Department's attempts to expedite Alice's case to closure to ease the public's mind, soon after her murder, before homicide investigators could even catch a breath, two more horrific slayings took place.
Native creates products with trusted ingredients and trusted performance. Just check out their over 8,000 five-star reviews from customers. Native deodorant has fewer, simpler ingredients, so you know everything that's in your deodorant, and you know that it's safe and effective without aluminum, which may be linked to some serious health ramifications. I've tried a million of these other safe ingredient deodorants, and I could just never find one that actually worked for me. But Native really does work. I use it every day, and I'm sticking with my favorite scent, the coconut and vanilla. It's their most popular scent, and I can tell why, because it smells really good, and it lasts throughout the whole day. Native also comes in a wide variety of other enticing scents for men and women, like lavender and rose, and cucumber and mint. Plus, they release new limited edition seasonal scents throughout the year. So right now, they have a pumpkin spice latte scent and a sweet almond and honey scent. That one sounds so good. I might have to try that next. There's absolutely no risk to try, as Native offers free returns and exchanges in the USA. For 20% off your first purchase, visit nativedeodorant.com and use promo code GONECOLD during checkout. That's 20% off your first purchase at nativedeodorant.com with promo code GONECOLD. Bye, y'all.
On a tranquil, dead-end street in northwest Houston, outside the Interstate 610 loop, lived Doris Lynn Threadgill in a plush townhouse. Doris lived alone in August of 1979, and though she was married, Doris was presumably separated from her husband. The 27-year-old woman was the second oldest of four daughters born to Faye and Robert Armstrong, and Doris was poised to take over the beauty supply business that her parents co-founded, Armstrong McCall's, a business that had been around in Corpus Christi since 1939 and would have the Armstrong family moving from town to town in Texas Doris's whole life, before they finally settled down in Lockhart, where Doris graduated from high school in 1971. In the top 10 of her high school class, Doris moved from college to college, starting at Texas Christian University in Fort Worth, to Southwest Texas State in San Marcos, and finally settling into the University of Houston, where she received her bachelor's degree in business technology in 1977. "We thought she would never get out of school because she changed her major so much," her mother later told the press. Doris had also received training for and completed certification to be an industrial audiometric technician from Southern Methodist University in Dallas, essentially meaning she was licensed to administer hearing tests to workers at their places of employment. And by August 1979, she was working as an accountant for Biological Testing Incorporated, a company that studied the effects of environmental factors in industrial plants, such as noise levels. Doris also dabbled in professional modeling and was hired out for shoots through Houston agency CoverGirl. She was reportedly quite the artist, too. She loved people. Her face was beautiful. She had a love of life and a love of art. She loved dancing, photography, anything beautiful, her mother, Faye, later told a Chronicle reporter. At around 9 a.m. on the morning of Friday, August 10th, 1979, an exterminator was scheduled to come out to Doris's townhouse to spray for pests. When he arrived, the door was ajar. His knocks and calls for her went unanswered. He entered the home to perform his duties. It isn't clear just where in the townhouse the exterminator found Doris's body, but it is certain that what he saw could never be erased from his memory. Doris laid on her back. She was clothed, though the clasp of her pants was undone and the zipper down. She'd been stabbed multiple times in her chest and in her back. Her throat had been so severely cut that it was almost detached from her body, almost as if her killer was attempting to remove it, but was frightened away. When investigators arrived on the scene, nothing could prepare them for the gruesome sight. The crime scene, according to retired Sergeant Brian Foster, was contaminated by the many patrol officers who visited. There were no signs of forced entry, no signs of theft as a motive, and Doris had not been sexually assaulted. It was determined by the medical examiner that Doris had been dead for about 12 hours. Her townhome remained largely unscathed by the violence that had taken place there, unlike the scene of yet another brutal killing that would be discovered just hours later. 26-year-old Mary Michael Calcutta was described by Houston homicide detective Jim Benford as a flower on the pavement. Though they declined to be interviewed for this episode, We spoke with Mary's sister, Margaret, and brother Jim about her and her life. A native of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Mary worked at a bakery there, a passion of hers, but upon visiting a friend in Houston, realized that she'd rather enjoy life in the warm climate of Texas than deal with the harsh and long winters of Pittsburgh. After moving to Houston, Mary took up work at a bank, but was also sure to feed her passion by keeping a part-time job at a bakery. Settling right into Texas life, she quickly picked up another passion, country western line dancing. Like the rest of her family, she was one of six children born to Margaret and Joseph Calcutta. Mary was a devout Catholic. Her sister became a nun, and one of her brothers sought training to become a priest, though he didn't complete it. At only 26, Mary was already worldly beyond her young age, having traveled inside and outside the United States, even visiting the Vatican and Rome. She was experienced, but also innocent in a sense. According to both her brother and sister, she wasn't a heavy drinker or regular partier, and most often chose to spend time around her church group rather than the bars, unlike many of the single residents living in the area she resided. Her apartment was in the Orchard apartment complex, and though the Orchard lost many residents after Alice Rankin was savagely murdered and beheaded there, Mary stayed. It wasn't that the slang hadn't had the same effect on her. In fact, Mary had stayed with a friend for over a week immediately after, but she was strong-willed and brave. Mary expressed to a friend that fear lingered, but told her that she wasn't going to open the door to strangers, and Mary told her friend that she'd been pushing her bookcase against the door. On Friday, August 10th, 1979, Mary Calcutta hadn't been back at her apartment long. At 4:30 p.m., just 7.5 hours after the discovery of Doris Lynn Threadgill's body, less than 6 miles away, a male friend of Mary's came to visit. While it isn't clear if the door was ajar or if her friend opened it after his knocks went unanswered, he entered Mary's apartment to a sight that was shocking and inconceivable. An intense struggle had taken place there.
She was attacked again with a knife, and she fought very hard all through the apartment and made it into the bathroom where she was stabbed to death. She was stabbed with such vigor that the knife literally went through with the butcher knife, went through the body and bent on the floor, and then was used multiple times more for stab wounds. You could tell which ones because of the shape of the wound. And she was almost decapitated. It was, don't know whether somebody scared him off or whether the extensive fight she put up made him tired and he didn't finish the job on that one.
Mary Calcutta sustained stab wounds to her chest and her back. The killer either didn't know Mary was capable of putting up the fight that she did, or he was overconfident in his own abilities. Since Mary insisted to her friends that she'd been taking precautions and wasn't going to open the door to strangers, it is at least plausible that her killer did know that she could defend herself, or perhaps she neglected to mention the years she'd spent in martial arts training. Mary knew damn well how to defend herself, and though the defensive wounds she sustained proved that fact, the knife-wielding monster, in the end, overcame her. She was wearing a nightgown and slippers when she was brutally slain, and the trail of blood began at the kitchen. Mary sustained cuts and stabs all the way to her bathroom, where it was obvious she sought to retreat to, scooting back, seeking refuge between the toilet and wall, as the perpetrator continued cutting and stabbing. Mary Calcutta died harder than any murdered woman I ever worked, lead detective Jim Benford later remarked to the press. She fought her killer until she couldn't fight him anymore. She was the flower that grows in the crack of the sidewalk, that blossoms, and you know it's a matter of time before it gets stepped on and broken up. he added. Mary's spine was almost severed as a result of the attack. Her throat slashed deeply. The slayer rinsed and wiped the knife that had become bent at the tip as a result of the violent stabbing, leaving it behind on the scene. Women in the Orchard apartment complex were racing to buy firearms to protect themselves, or moving out entirely. Investigators were appalled and baffled. A second murder of a single woman in the Orchard apartment complex, exactly 2 weeks after the first, the second death of a single woman due to unspeakable violence and brutality that day, August 10, 1979, all three strikingly similar. Detectives couldn't help but wonder if all three slayings were the work of one individual, and it wouldn't be long until they'd find a common link between two of the victims. After Mary Calcutta and Doris Threadgill's murders on Friday, August 10, 1979, and Alice Rankin's murder 2 weeks prior on July 27th, which all bore similarities difficult to ignore, Houston police were determined to stop the madman they theorized could be responsible for them all. Even the most seasoned homicide detectives were shaken, but they knew they had to act. At Mary's apartment, one crime scene investigator utilized a technique he'd been working on in his spare time, one which hadn't been employed much, if at all, by the Houston Police Department up until Alice Rankin's brutal murder, macro photography. The investigator took extreme close-ups of blood spatter, blood patterns, and Mary's body, and to preserve the crime scene, hung from lifts to do so, where if he hadn't, evidence might have been compromised. The lead detective on Mary and Alice's case, Jim Benford, spent many sleepless nights patrolling the Orchard apartments, several in which he spent on the complex's roof wearing night vision goggles in an attempt to catch the killer in another act and take him off guard. "We've got 500,000 suspects and nobody in jail," another detective, D.M. Foltz, told the Houston Post. Homicide Lieutenant Chuck Laughland told the press 3 days after Mary and Doris's murder that they were poring over the three victims' lives and backgrounds in search of any connection, but thus far had only linked Mary and Alice together since they both lived at the Orchard apartments. Another connection between Mary and Alice, though, would come to investigators' attention virtually as Lieutenant Laughlin's words were being printed. Mary Calcutta was taken to Pittsburgh to be given a funeral mass and to be buried, and her boyfriend flew there to attend. Mary's brother put him up in his home. The priest who conducted the mass at St. Raphael Church there, according to retired Sergeant Brian Foster, received a confession that day from Mary's boyfriend, and it wasn't a typical confession, but a horrific account of a murder he'd committed. Though Mary's boyfriend didn't give the name of his victim and wasn't forthcoming with the details, he told the priest that the victim was someone known to them both. The priest subsequently confided in Mary's sister what the man had told him, according to retired homicide Sergeant Brian Foster, but refused to go to police himself because of the breach of confidentiality. Mary's sister was livid at the priest's refusal to cooperate in the investigation of her murder. She, of course, wasted no time phoning Houston detectives to let them in on it, which began a hard look at an individual who would end up being tied both to Mary and Alice, a University of Houston psychology student, one who police had asked, according to Sergeant Foster, to undergo a polygraph test, and who refused that request when police began the initial investigation into Alice Rankin's murder. The psychology student was among the men Alice Rankin had dated, and was Mary's boyfriend at the time of her death.
He could dated them both and readily admitted having relations with both of them. And so his fingerprints would be in the apartments, and all of the body fluids would have been there too. It was just a situation where it was almost plausible and would be plausible in somebody else's minds that this evidence would be there, and he would just happen to have dated both of them. I guess in police work, your brain is not accepting of innocence from anybody, including Mosley Teresa, probably. You would call a lead investigator on a regular basis wanting to know if he had discovered our murder suspect or had got enough information to charge our murder suspect, is it the term he would use. And it was apparently like goading the police from what the investigator told me. There were no other suspects, no other killings like that that we could link to it and have not been able to link to it.
Mary Calcutta's family was told by friends of hers that Mary was either in the process of breaking up with the psychology student or that she intended to soon. And according to retired Sergeant Brian Foster, Mary had confided in friends and co-workers about her boyfriend's strange sexual fetish, one which some psychologists have deemed normal, while others suggest that the purpose of which is degradation, humiliation, and an exertion of power and control. Though Alice Rankin had dated him, it is unclear if she'd continued to date him when she was egregiously slain, or if, when, and how their breakup occurred. Regardless of Houston detectives' near certainty that Mary and Alice's psychology student boyfriend was involved in their murders, if not Doris Threadgill's too, who'd also attended the University of Houston just 2 years prior to her death, police were ultimately unable to tie him to any of the murders, and he'd go on to practice psychology in Houston, specializing in marriage counseling and adult relationships. Two more vicious murders that occurred just shy of 2 months later, anyway, spread the Houston Police Department's homicide division even thinner. On Wednesday, October 3rd, 1979, 16-year-old Joanne Huffman and 18-year-old Robert Spangenberger, who planned to marry, went out for a normal night together, dining at a local restaurant. Late that evening, Houston police were notified by individuals living near Freed Park who'd heard gunshots. Freed Park is in northwest Houston, mere blocks from where, less than 2 months earlier, Doris Lynn Threadgill was found, savagely slain in her townhome. When police arrived at the home of one resident who'd called, the resident telling them they'd witnessed a white male in a cap or a flat hat dragging a teenaged girl by her hair toward the house across the street as she screamed blood-curdling screams for help, begging the man not to hurt her. An intense struggle occurred on the porch. Just before this took place, police received reports of gunshots. The gunshots were thought to have come from Freed Park, which was just behind the house where the struggle between the girl and the man in the cap took place. Police were unable to find any signs that violence had occurred and cleared the calls, saying the sounds heard were likely firecrackers. The next morning, Thursday, October 4th, 1979, however, blood was found on the porch where the reported struggle took place, and police began a search for the girl. That afternoon, 16-year-old Joanne Huffman was found dead, face down by a cyclist in Watonga Park, about 4 miles away. She'd been shot through her mouth, the firearm in an upwards position, the bullet piercing her brain. She was clothed, but wore no shoes or underwear. Not far from where Joanne's body was discovered, less than a mile away on the 4200 block of Mangum Road, and at almost the same time, the sales manager of a car dealership happened upon a white Dodge that didn't belong on the lot. The keys were in the ignition of the vehicle, and though there was obvious dried blood smears, the sales manager retrieved the keys and opened the trunk. Inside, to the horror of the man, was the headless body of 18-year-old Robert Spangenberger. In the vehicle, police found Joanne Huffman's underwear, panties and bra, and her shoes. Her purse was also inside. The trunk contained enough blood for police to theorize that his head had been removed there. In Robert's pocket was $12. No clues, no physical evidence, such as fingerprints, were found on the car. And Robert Spangenberger's head was never located. The Orchard Apartment murders of Alice Rankin and Mary Calcutta, along with the deaths of Doris Lynn Threadgill, Joanne Huffman, and Robert Charles Spangenberger, spun tales of a serial killer, one who was never brought to justice, and are infamous stories well known by Houstonians, most often told synonymously with one another. But these tragic deaths and the uncertainty that accompany them, each individual unsolved and cold case, are far more than urban legends to the detectives, officers, and first responders who witnessed the carnage firsthand, and, most importantly, remain an unresolved reality and point of anguish for the many family members that the victims left behind. The perpetrator or perpetrators possibly continue to live and enjoy their life. There's been no justice. Most likely, the remaining family members who were left behind to pick up the pieces after Alice, Doris, Joanne, and Robert's murders are still haunted by the fates they met, presumably still seeking or hoping for justice. Mary Calcutta's family certainly are. Whenever Mary's siblings gather on holidays or special occasion, her murder always, perhaps inevitably, comes up. Both Mary's sister and brother expressed to us the frustration that mounts year after year as nothing new is turned up. And though they realize the weight on the shoulders of police, the lack of funding for the cold case department, the inability to be proactive, opting to wait until new leads come in rather than going out and digging them up, since current cases take priority, Mary's case, they feel, has been given up on. In 2010, cold case detectives at the Houston Police Department, upon submitting evidence to the crime lab for then state-of-the-art testing, told the Houston Chronicle that they still believe Alice Rankin and Mary Calcutta's cases are connected, both murdered by the same individual, and said they couldn't rule out Doris Threadgill's murder as connected to them as well. But they think Robert Spangenberger and Joanne Huffman's murderer is someone else entirely. Unfortunately, additional forensic testing sent to the lab in 2010 provided dismal results. The number one person of interest in both Alice and Mary's murders, the psychology student who they both dated, continued to call lead investigator Jim Binford every 3 to 6 months for years, asking if they were any closer, according to retired Houston Homicide Sergeant Brian Foster. But the calls came less and less after that, until they stopped altogether.
You know, a good intelligent psychopath, or even an organized psychopath, is a dangerous animal, and some of them are smart enough not they don't have to be bright to figure out that they need to change their MOs. Serial killers either they think they're either smarter than you are, or they think they're not as smart as you. And the ones who think they're smarter than you are, they're not above toying with you or trying to act smug. And it's an attitude that a normal person or a normal thinking person cannot come up with or understand. And it's not worth even trying to. It's like there was a Texas Ranger I knew that was a heck of a good cop. And he'd say, you know, you can't think like a crook. You can anticipate, you can analyze what he's done, but you can't think like one does. Don't even try. Just try to pick up the pieces, You can't explain the why. A normal person cannot do such a thing. A normal person can't figure out why they did such a thing. Don't bother. And if you can, I wouldn't admit it to anybody.
We've been told this person of interest still practices psychology in Houston to this day. If you have any information about the murders of Alice Elaine Rankin, Mary Michael Calcutta, Doris Lynn Threadgill, Robert Charles Spangenberger, or Joanne Huffman, please call the Houston Police Department Cold Case Squad at 713-308-3618. We'd like to thank Sister Margaret and Jim for speaking with us, and thanks too to Sergeant Foster for his contribution. The Houston Chronicle, the Houston Post, the Paris News, the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, the New York Times, and retired Houston Homicide Sergeant Brian Foster's book, They Were Graveyard Dead, were used as sources for this episode. Sergeant Foster worked homicide for years, and it's interesting how he got started writing.
Well, I collected strange confessions and statements and bizarre stuff over the years, and we'd sit around and read them and laugh at some of them. And every time a street animal said something weird, I wrote it down in a ledger book, and that wound up being the basis on the first couple of books. I'd write a short story and throw a statement in there, or confession. Or two or three confessions or statements that made no sense at all, but came out of the same incident, and you never would have known it if you hadn't been involved in it. The first book was Homicidal Humor, because anytime you work homicides, you gotta look for a humorous release. Because if you internalize what you see, it'll eat you alive. I don't care whether you're in a high pressure vocation, you've got to look for humor. Working in an emergency room, driving an ambulance, It's what you've got to look for, or it'll eat you up. And it does eat some guys up. Then I was approached by a coworker who wanted me to write his career case. And so I had been writing other people's career cases. And every cop, particularly investigator, has a career case that either sits in his stomach and twists when he thinks about it, or that he's real proud of. So when you ask him, you got a career case, most everybody says yes. I'm on the third in that series. But it's worked out well for me. I have no right to complain about my lot in life.
If you'd like to support Gone Cold Podcast, Texas True Crime, you can find out how by visiting patreon.com/Gone Cold Podcast. There are several varying donation levels there to choose from, with perks to go along with each, including ad-free listening at all levels. Donations help us cover the costs of research and production, and we can't thank y'all enough for your support. Thanks for listening, y'all.